Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 3 issues for just £5. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Hello and welcome back to Blacks History Week. To Americans, a tyrant. To British radicals, a reactionary. To dramatists, a madman. And to many of his subjects, a well-intentioned and fundamentally moderate ruler holding his realm together in a Europe assailed by absolutists, dictators, and revolutionaries. Do any of these caricatures of George III fit? In this podcast, Professor Jeremy Black, author of George III, America's Last King, and most recently, George III, Majesty and Madness, talks to The Critic's political editor, Graham Stewart, about the 60-year reign of a man brought up to be the embodiment of a patriot king.
Professor Jeremy Black, in recent weeks, we've been discussing in these podcasts the role of American presidents, the power they've held, and how they've exercised that power. This week, we want to turn to King George III, the last king of America, as well as, of course, being king of Great Britain. If we place George III, who was king for 60 years, from 1760 to 1820, if we place George III in the context of other rulers at the same time, Frederick the Great of Prussia, Joseph II in Vienna, and indeed George Washington in the newly independent United States, how would his concept of kingship differ from or be similar either to enlightened despots on the European continent or to the first president of the United States?
Well, I think George would be very similar because all of these were individuals who believed in operating in accordance with the law being something that was not simply a matter of their will. So from that perspective, although the constitutional and political formulations of that varied by country, they would all have considered themselves very different from those that, fairly or unfairly, they stigmatized as despots of their own era. So, for example, their image of a Ottoman Sultan would be somebody, and sometimes these were accurate, sometimes these were inaccurate, views of somebody who would be able to kill at will. And they would also have had images of early rulers, particularly Roman emperors, and particularly the persecutors of the primitive church, who would similarly have been arbitrary. And it's worth bearing in mind, so, you know, we come to the point straight away, because obviously this is a world which is very much concerned with present-day occurrences, that to all of these rulers, the one's often asked about slavery and the slave trade, and of course, under George III, Britain was a slave-trading state, had slavery in some, not all, of its colonies, and ditto from Washington. Of course, from their perspective, they didn't see this as necessarily bad or good. We can discuss this. But one of the things they would certainly have noted is, and something that seems to be passed a lot of attention these days by, is that African rulers were only too happy to sell Africans into the slave trade. And that they would have seen as being rather different from their own position. Now, we can draw attention to aspects of hypocrisy in aspects of Western kingship, but I think it's fair to say that they had an image of what the law might be, and that that was, in their eyes, one that put them in a different position.
Well, in George's case, as we look at how he developed his view of his role, we should perhaps start with his upbringing. His father died when he was young, so key influences were his German mother, Augusta, and also the Scottish Episcopalian John Stuart, Earl of Bute. How significant were these early influences in developing George's view, and in what direction did they guide him?
Were, but I'd actually include his father. I mean, George is born in 1738. His father dies, Prince Frederick, Prince of Wales, dies in 1751. George, in many senses, imbued his father's notion of politics and kingship, and in particular the idea of a ruler who was beyond or above, depending upon what image you wish to use, party, and tried to rule with all and for all. And that was very much Prince Frederick's idea, the so-called country party idea of Tories and opposition Whigs, and going together and trying to move away from the monopoly of power associated with the old core Whigs, the Whig party of Sir Robert Walpole, Henry Pelham, the Duke of Newcastle, which was the system that George I and George II had supported. So I would say that the absolute key is that George III tries to bring forward his father's image. And of course, he wouldn't have been alone. I mean, psychologically, the idea of trying to bring to fulfillment what your dead father has sought to do is one that is a quite common male trope in behaviour. And of course, there is a similar political text in the case that, in case of Bolingbroke and Bolingbroke's writings about country party opposition. And in many senses, this is what George III saw himself as trying to do. And he saw himself, it provides a unity for him politically. I mean, obviously, as you will know, his political career went up and down, to put it mildly. But throughout his period of political awareness, in other words, before his mind was clouded in his last decade, George III always saw himself as somebody who was trying to rule for all, and always saw himself as somebody who was trying to hold at bay a narrow factional partisanship, and in particular that associated with one-party rule. And to that extent, I mean, he falls into a classic line. I mean, it's very interesting. At the beginning, you compared him with a number of other figures. He falls into a classic line of about monarchy, the idea that the ruler should seek be equally offer justice to all his subjects. It's a notion that you can see in the Christian tradition going back through to the kings of Israel of the Old Testament. You can see it in non-Christian traditions of monarchy. And the idea of the king as the law giver and the king as a sort of semi-sacral figure. And I think it's fair to say that that tradition was revived strongly. I mean, you know, one tends to talk about Bolingbroke and one tends to look at secular accounts, but actually, in terms of cultural iconography, it's revived very strongly in Britain in the 1730s, 1740s, 1750s, in the performances of Handel's oratorios and the accounts of Old Testament kingship, and, you know, Saul and David and so on. And of course, as we know, well know, George III, it is not just me producing some abstract idea, you know, what I call history in the bath. You put some historian in the bath and they think about some brilliant idea and then write about it. And the only problem with it is that it actually has no basis in accuracy. As we know, George III was a great patron of Handel. He was a key figure in the Handel revival of the 1780s. George III, in some respects, can be seen in his own eyes as a kind of Old Testament king.
And, well, in that notion, the Old Testament king, but also the patriot king that Bolingbroke developed, the king of, you know, above party faction. There's a problem, though, isn't there, in that, you know, under the previous two Georges, the Whig oligarchy has been the royal approved power in the country, and of course winning the general elections as well. But the Whigs have associated themselves with the revolution, the Glorious Revolution settlement. Is there a sense that the young George III, with his favouritism towards the Tory Earl of Bute and with his sense of not being aligned purely with the Whig Party. Is there a sense or a fear that actually he therefore doesn't accept that glorious revolution, 1688-89
well,
settlement?
Can I just, for the benefit of listeners, make one or two points? First of all, you know this, Graham, but listeners may not be aware of this. Governments in the 18th century didn't lose general elections, and general elections did not reflect majority views. So I think that's a point that we need to bring out very, very clearly. Number two, George always saw himself as under the law and in accordance with the Constitution. He very much differentiated himself from the Stuarts on the grounds precisely that they had, in his eyes, departed from the Constitution and the support both of the legal establishment in both state and church. He took the view very clearly that his position rested not on hereditary divine rule, but on essentially parliamentary decision-making, both the expulsion of the Stuarts and also the act of settlement. So I think you were in danger there of falling into the Whig mythos. And I would say that the other argument that you were presenting there was the notion of the Tories of the, as in some way in the mid-18th century, as a sort of group of malign intentions out to subvert the Constitution. Well, as you will know, first of all, there is a massive literature out there that's worth reading on the politics of the mid 18th century, and I can mention without exhausting the subject for a second distinguished books by people such as Colley and Clark and O'Gorman on the politics of that period. But to put it mildly, it puts a whole host of question marks about the characterization of both the Whigs and the Tories in the kind of 18th or 19th century terms of critics of George III. And I think what is fair to say is that there had been a Jacobite movement, that Jacobite movement had been significant among many Tories. I think that is true. And I think in that case, I think the work of Evelyn Cruikshank is very convincing. And there I would not agree completely with Linda Colley's book on the Tories under G1 and G2, but also there was a strong tradition of what one might call Hanoverian Tories. Those are Tories who had adjusted and adapted to the Hanoverian dynasty, and that group was very much in the ascendant among those whom you might call Tories from the mid-1740s onwards, and of course those people very much focused on Frederick Prince of Wales, and in many senses the young Prince George took over much of his father's clientage, groupings, ideas. So if you wish to present some idea, as in some Whig, you know, conspiracy theory, of a conspiracy centered on George, you have to extend that back to include Prince Frederick, plus all the Whigs, a variety of people such as George Doddington, who looked to Prince Frederick. So I would be very wary of that. You're absolutely right that paranoia and conspiracy theory is very much to the fore in a lot of the discussion of British politics in the 1760s, but I would hope we know enough, thinking of our own dear age, when there's no such thing as conspiracy or paranoia, and when social media is full of objective accounts of political decision-making, I hope that we would be sufficiently wary of some of the equivalents of the 18th century, not to read them as historical documents.
Well, I think some of those conspiracy theorists and propagandists would have been very interested in a quote that appears in your new book, George III, Majesty and Madness. And you quote George III saying, in reference to Gustavus III's suppression of the Swedish Age of Liberty in 1772, you quote George III as saying, "I never will acknowledge that the king of a limited monarchy can on any principle endeavour to change the constitution and increase his own power. No honest man will attempt it." Do you feel that he was speaking from the heart there, or was he speaking in a way which he felt was what he ought to say, but he nevertheless had autocratic tendencies that went beyond the limited monarchy of his period?
No, I think when he's writing and for personal reasons to individuals, in other words, when he speaks in the House, in Parliament, gives a royal speech, he's obviously, that is structured to an extent by the government. When he writes to individuals, and as you may know with George III, he wrote in his own hand till the mid-1800s. I mean, he says what he's thinking. And George III's comment on Gustavus III very much reflected his views and reflected his subsequent attitudes towards Gustavus. He didn't change his views as far as Gustavus is concerned. And I think it's fair to say that if you look at George's view precepts, both as far as continental monarchs are concerned and as far as his British predecessors are concerned, I think it's fair to say that he is not somebody who has the autocratic tendencies. I mean, as you mentioned, it's kind of you to mention my book. I mean, my book is a 30,000-worder for the Penguin series. I was asked to write it. Somebody else had agreed to write it, and they pulled out, and I was asked to write it. And as you may know, it rests not just on the new work I did for that book, but also on a much larger book, the 200,000-worder, so that's a big book indeed, for the Yale British Monarchs series, which came out in the mid-2000s. And, you know, I'm sure that somebody somewhere could find something I'd missed out, but I tried to read every single letter that George wrote. That's made easier by the fact that most of his letters are really very short. But then again, if you're the king, I mean, you could do what I call speaking clearly. You can write clearly. You know, I'd like to feel that one has an ability to understand somebody. It doesn't mean you agree with them in all respects, and there are aspects of George III that I would have found, you know, different. But I'd like to feel that I understand him. I mentioned in the big book the danger of what one calls the Stockholm syndrome. You know, you fall in love with your subject and you become overly sympathetic. I would like to think I haven't done that. I think George could be stubborn. He could fail sometimes to understand the situation he was in. He could show a difficulty at making compromise, which is so often the flip side of integrity. But I think integrity is the root thing that is there. He was a man of enormous integrity. Interestingly enough, as you may know, I also did a biography of George II, and separate to that, I also wrote a book on the Hanoverian dynasty as a whole. And I would say that G1 and G2 also show integrity, but their personalities are different. But interestingly enough, neither of those men can be said to have been people that were trying to subvert the Constitution, however, whatever you mean by that. And you have to be careful of that, because that implies a more fixed reality than was necessarily the case. But neither of those men tried to subvert the Constitution. And although George III was worried that, in fact, the Constitution, and here he takes on board Bolingbroke's arguments, that the Constitution had, as it were, been subverted by the Whig oligarchs, his intention is to, as it were, restore kingship to what he thinks it ought to be, which is a monarch ruling on behalf of all his subjects, rather than a monarch ruling as a party monarch. So George III is very different in his intentions to his predecessor, his grandfather George II. But that does not mean that one is an autocrat or would be autocrat and the other is not.
So when we look at the American interpretation of George as a tyrant, I mean, most recently familiar in the kind of pantomime villain in the musical Hamilton, but I mean, long before that, almost throughout, you know, from the revolutionary propagandists onwards, throughout most history writing and most popular knowledge in America, where does this, particularly this American notion of George III as a arch-reactionary despot, come from? And should particularly American criticism, should it more be focused on leading politicians in Westminster at that time rather than the king himself?
Well, I'm always I think that's the right question to ask. It's where it comes from, not is it accurate. I mean, it's clearly inaccurate, but where it comes from is an interesting thing. And when you say the American interpretation, I think it's more fair to say the interpretation of those Americans, we should call them the patriots, if you like, who rebelled against the king. It's worth bearing in mind that roughly the same number of Americans, of course, supported the king, and a large number also were neutral or just sat on their hands. So it's worth bearing in mind there are American views about George III, entirely as you would expect. It was a civil war in America, in the 13 colonies, and that element tends, quite understandably, to be downplayed in subsequent American history, entirely understandable, but we should be wary of assuming a mythos, an account, as representing the views of all Americans. Right. Now then, let's look at the question of the Patriot account of George III. The Patriots quite rightly identified a sense of loyalty to the king and to the monarchy as a more potent factor than a sense of loyalty to parliamentary rule from Westminster. And that, in a way, helps to account for their focus of their anger, in the case of the Declaration of Independence, 1776, on the king, because the king is seen as the key linkage. Now, separate to that, of course, there is also the notion, as you argue, of the language of the king as a tyrant, which, of course, in many respects goes back to Old Testament views. Bad kings are to be removed or are people that are pernicious. It goes right back also to the idea that you will see in some of the propaganda of the king as being like a bad father. And so that you get a whole host of ideas contributing to this animosity towards George. Did George deserve it? No, not really. I mean, he didn't respond in the wisest of fashions to what was going on. There was a lack of understanding, I think, in British government as a whole about the extent and strength and ambition of opposition to British policy in the early 1770s. By British policy, I mean the policy of the government. And I think it's also worth saying that in that period, governments were not used to the idea that you would give up control over some of your colonies. And in a way, to see a way through this crisis was a difficult one. Now, in my perspective, and again, I've written a book, well, many books, on War of Independence, on geopolitics, covering the period, etc., etc. In my perspective, it became a cost that was disproportionate to the potential benefit. But people don't always operate in terms of rational cost basis and cost benefit analysis, assuming that is that you can even propose that that is something that you can evaluate in an optimal fashion, and that's dubious. There is a whole host of factors bound up in ideas of obedience, ideas of identity, ideas of loyalty, and ideas of role. And George III, who is inherently a fairly a man who is so convinced of his own integrity that he doesn't always find it easy to accept that others have with integrity differing views, George is not particularly flexible in terms of either his goals or his methods. I mean, there was a cop-out, an opt-out, if you like, in 1778. France comes into the war against the British. The opt-out would have been, quite obviously, to focus on the French. But George remains determined to try and regain control of the 13 colonies. But, you know, it's easy to criticize the king To have abandoned all the loyalists would have been a very harsh injunction. And of course, the other thing which is ironic, which I'm not saying this is why George fought the war, but you're asking me in terms of the modern day, it's worth bearing in mind that the, insofar as they took sides, more of the Native Americans backed connection with Britain than they backed the connection with the Patriots, not surprisingly, and of course, more African Americans backed the British than backed the slave-owning patriots. So I think it's worth bearing in mind that this is a much more complex account than is sometimes, and complex matter than is sometimes suggested. I'm not implying that George III was fighting for the benefit of Native Americans or African Americans. I'm just simply saying that some of the modern accounts of it as a struggle for liberty, you can put a jolly big question mark against.
And how far did King George see this foreign policy as raw prerogatives, which allowed him to be intimately involved in both military and strategic decisions? Or was he, I mean, a lot of the generals had to obviously be left because of the distance and time involved, left to make their own decisions on the ground. But how minutely involved really was George in the waging of war in America?
Well, you can read George's correspondence. I mean, let's start off. A lot of it is now available in a rather superb internet searchable. But I mean, when I was looking at it, obviously, I had to both look at it in archival sources, but there's also for those people who have old-fashioned books. There are the 6 volumes edited by J.B. Fortescue of George's correspondence. There are the 5 volumes on his later correspondence edited by Aspinall. There's the volume edited by Sedgwick of his correspondence with Bute. There is an enormous amount out there. And what I think this can fairly show is that this was a very hard-working monarch. I mean, to give you an idea of his routine, which I discuss in the big book, the king was accustomed to rise early. He did a certain number of hours correspondence, essentially, and we can tell when he did it because the king dated the starting a letter, and most of his letters were just one paragraph, sometimes two, but he dated it to the second he started writing it. So you can actually follow the king's day with a certain degree of ease. He would then, after a light breakfast, take exercise. The king was very keen on exercise, very modern in some respects. Walking and riding were his two main forms of exercise. He would then in the afternoon generally do much more correspondence, and he would then in the evening have early dinner, didn't eat very much, and go to bed relatively early. So the king worked very hard, and he also, of course, saw his ministers. He saw foreign envoys. If the question is, which you asked, is you were implying, did he intervene too much? No, as you correctly say, foreign policy was the royal prerogative. Diplomats were accredited, foreign diplomats were accredited to the crown, and the army was operating in his name. But he quite clearly accepted the roles of ministers, the secretaries of state for foreign policy, the Admiralty Board for the Navy, the Commander-in-Chief for the Army. Didn't mean he didn't have views, and he did often express his views, but he was not somebody who one would describe as a micromanager. I think that would be going too far. It would also be beyond his scope. I mean, he simply, as an individual, didn't have the time to write to every British ambassador and, you know, to write to the colonel of every regiment or the commander of every warship. But he often did express views. So, for example, if he thought that a naval officer had behaved with considerable bravery, he would write to the Admiralty Board and say how impressed he was and how he hoped X could be promoted. He took a close personal interest in church patronage. I mean, whereas his grandfather and his great-grandfather had essentially left the appointment of bishoprics largely up to the ministry, George III had the unfashionable idea of assuming that somebody should have clerical commitment and integrity, so you don't get... I mean, it's rather interesting, this. Whereas the modern fashion of, you know, trying to appoint bishops who conform to whatever is the gender or other preferences of the present day, George III, of course, his basic requirement were that these people should be devout and quite clearly keen to do their job. And he himself was personally friends with Bishop Hurd, for example. He stayed with Bishop Hurd. He took this sort of stuff very seriously. He took very seriously the royal prerogative of mercy. He took the view that when people were hung, they were hung, the justice was the king's, and he expected to review the death penalties. And he, on the whole, was merciful. His general view was that you should be executed if you were a recidivist, but if you were a first offender, he was very keen on the exercise of mercy.
He famously pleaded for mercy for a deranged woman who attempted to assassinate him with a fruit knife, I think it was. You speak about his devoutness. Among the key issues of the period is obviously Catholic emancipation, to which he sets himself very clearly against, and sets himself, particularly in the latter years of his reign, on a collision course with his more reform-minded ministers. Was this, do you think, a sense of, you know, what is he saw as his coronation oaths that had to be maintained, or was this a strong religious view, a religious prejudice, which was which maintained that the Anglican Church was really the only church for any reasonable person to belong to?
Well, in the big book, I have a whole chapter, a big chapter, it's I think possibly the best of the chapters, on George and religion, because I think it's very important and it links up to all sorts of things, including his view on social behaviour and actually also his views on the family. First of all, he is not personally against Catholics. He goes to stay with Catholics, for example, in a way that his grandfather and his great-grandfather had never done. You know, stay in their houses. So he's not personally against Catholics. He takes, and he, as you will be aware, he actually takes the view that the Catholic Church is something which is similarly threatened by the French Revolution, and that he and the Pope are figures who are part of an order trying to fight against disorder. So I would not say that you've got somebody who is looking in terms of, you know, 17th century anti-papalism. I think that would be a misleading view. But as you correctly say, he is not somebody keen on constitutional experimentation. I think that's very correct. And he does not wish to change the structure under which the Church of England is the established church, and there are civil disabilities that are associated with being a member of other religions. And of course, it's not just Catholics, it's also Protestant nonconformists, let alone, I mean, people who are non-Christians. So there are civil disabilities there. There are things you cannot do. You can't be, let's say, a colonel. You know, the king believes that he has sworn in his coronation oath to protect that. But I also think he actually does think it's not a generally good idea to be changing the constitution very much. And I think he is cautious about that. And you can see comments about, you know, that he makes, some of them jokes. I mean, when he talks to the Duke of Norfolk, who is a reformer, and the Duke of Norfolk is doing building work at his castle, and, you know, the king is basically on to him about a joke, which I don't think is a particularly brilliant joke, about how you must be very careful when you're, you know, rebuilding something, not to let you destroy the foundations, you know, and that very much reflects the king, and the king is there reflecting on his view on politics. I don't think it's helpful to see him as some kind of antiquated figure, but I think it's reasonable to say that it did cause problems with Pitt the Younger. I think Pitt the Younger was already, as I suggest in my book, already was starting to live on borrowed time politically by the end of the 1790s. So I think that one doesn't want to demonise the king over that. And I think, similarly, the fall of the Whig ministry that succeeded Pitt after he came back and then died. I think, again, it's more complicated than just Catholic emancipation as an issue. But obviously that provides a way for later Whigs to castigate the king as in some kind of bigot, which is how they liked to present him. I think we're sophisticated enough to know that political abuse is not a good way to judge individuals.
Well, a bigot and a reactionary he may not have been, but a conservative, surely he was, in the sense of, you know, keeping the status quo.
He is a conservative. I think there's no doubt about that. But I think it's worth bearing in mind that the country over which he rules breaks down this dichotomy between reform and conservatism, which is, I think, a very arid and rather foolish dichotomy. So that if you're thinking about the 1790s and 1800s, okay, they may not have Catholic emancipation, but they introduce income tax, the Ordnance Survey, the first national census, they get rid of the slave trade, they try and reform labour relations with the Combination Acts, not to the pleasure of some people, but nevertheless, that's what they're trying to do. They have Parliament union with Ireland, etc., etc., etc. This is not a conservatism of opposition to all and every change. And I think this idea, which you so often see, this kind of, you know, as it were, Hegelian synthesis and thesis and antithesis, I don't think that's very helpful. It is only people who do not understand conservatism that think of conservatism as a monolith. And these people are foolish, and alas, all too often, they are those people who write the history of our country.
So, a conservative but not a reactionary, but which sort of reforms, you've mentioned some of them, but which are the ones he was most keen on?
Again, I you know, when you said a conservative, not a reactionary, I think I would use the term I think that is a duality, a sort of Manichaean duality, which again I'm rather wary of. What I would prefer to say is that the king did not. What I would say is that in the 1770s with North and in the 1784 onwards with Pitt the Younger, and then in the 1800s with Addington and later Portland, the king supports his ministers whom are trying to maintain the bulk of, if you like, the existing system, but making those changes that they see as appropriate to it. Now, I don't see that as either, as it were, as it were, a clear opposition to reactionary. I'm not quite sure what a reactionary position would be on the government of India, say, in the late 1780s. I think that, you know, that a lot of this is a matter of pragmatic responses, where it's not always clear what is the best and going to be the most successful policy. The king takes a lot of interest in it. On the whole, he supports his ministers. George III is a constitutional monarch. He doesn't spend his time trying to overturn them. He does, of course, with the Fox North ministry in December 1783, specifically, as you know, over the government of India, but he's also disinclined to them as a whole. But that is not how he conducts himself most of the time. Most of the time he works with his ministers, not against them. And what that actually means is that the king sees his role as supporting them. He does not see his role as sort of sitting there and saying, this can happen, that can't happen. On the whole, he's prepared to accept things even if he doesn't personally always like them or feel necessarily tremendously enthusiastic about them. But from 1793 onwards, Britain's involved in a war which by the end of 1794 is starting to be increasingly backs to the wall with chaps, and that remains the case for pretty well this entire rest of his adult life that he's alert for, with a brief period of peace in 1802-3. So everything else is subordinate to the need to fight the war. And I think that therefore abstract discussions of what might or might not have been a brilliant thing in peacetime become of relatively less importance when 1798 you've got French invade Ireland, you've got the first, second, third and fourth coalitions, all of which collapse, defeated by first the French revolutionaries and then by Napoleon, leaving Britain isolated. I think these are very much anxious days, and what they do is they encourage George to a number of resources which possibly we would not do today. I mean, so for example, he is keen on seeking divine support, but then he's not alone in that. There was a rather good piece, I thought, in the English Historical Review by Cuffey about the role of trying to seek divine approval as being one of the reasons why the slave trade is scrapped. So George has had a long tradition of, you know, seeking divine intercession, the idea also of people behaving themselves, you know, the Proclamation Society, people being encouraged not to blaspheme. So this is a kind of total struggle. Now, that might seem fantastical to us, but then, of course, I mean, we know that the British won in the end. I think for a lot of George's reign, the context that it's best thinking about is rather as if Britain in 1940-41, and the king, in many respects, is providing a much more central figure and focus in that than George VI did, although George VI played an important role, but than George VI did in 1940-41. And there was a well-known, very good piece by Linda Colley a number of years ago in which she referred to the increased affection for the king and the role of the king as a symbol of national identity, particularly in the 1800s. Almost irrespective of his political role, precisely because he becomes the antithesis of Napoleon. I mean, Napoleon is portrayed by the British, Gilray, etc., as a tyrant, which of course he was, as the man that's trying to redistribute the kingdoms of Europe, a man who doesn't believe in the rule of law. And George III is, on the other hand, presented as a more domestic character, a man of who's more measured, a more law-abiding, etc., etc. And I think these points are worth bearing in mind. Now, again, going back to what we said at the very beginning, what's interesting is you and I, both being people of a certain generation, I mean, I'm older than you, but both being historians trained in a certain practice, are not discussing it in terms of the modish notions of the present day. And as you know, modish notions of the present day and the aftermath or the shadow of the agitations about obsessionalism, almost, I would say, about the legacy of empire and so on, would probably have George III castigated, because his reign, 1760-1820, saw an enormous expansion of the empire. As far as India is concerned, it sees the British definitively defeating Mysore and the Maharathas and becoming the major military power in India, etc., etc., etc. And, I mean, I think that kind of context provides a way in which these days people look at the king, or they look at the Britain of that period, and it's worth bearing in mind many of these National Trust places and other stately homes being castigated. Well, those were places that George III would have visited, of course. And then again, you can add to it, you yourself have referred to Hamilton, and there is also the case that before the abolition of the slave trade, which occurs under George III, prior to that, of course, Britain is the largest slave trader in the world. So all of that would condition or affect a lot of modern discussion about the king. But what is interesting is at the time, those issues were not so central. For people within Britain, it's obviously George III as their king, a king who in many senses is a domestic figure, a king who is not seen as personally self-indulgent, as his son is to be seen, George IV, Prince Regent. People don't know very much about his personal taste, but in fact, in many senses, he comes out as a very sympathetic man. He likes music, he makes music, he's interested in art, he's uxorious, he's good relations with his wife, until, you know, when his mind goes. He tries to do the best by his children, doesn't always succeed, but then many parents would feel the same way. He's very interested in science, very interested in astronomy. He is a man who lacks arrogance, and he is a very impressive figure. Now, all of those features of him, in some respects, make him more comparable to, shall we say, George Washington, than either man, and they didn't meet each other, would probably have liked. And of course, George III famously got along very well with John Adams when John Adams becomes the first American ambassador to the Court of St. James. And I think it's worth bearing in mind that if you consider George in contrast with other rulers of his age, he can, you know, let's say Selim III in Turkey or the Qinlong Emperor in China or Napoleon, he is somebody who seeks to operate within the law, that the law is important to his conception of his duty. He believes very strongly in duty, and to that extent he is very similar to the present monarch, Queen Elizabeth. He is a man of enormous personal devotion, and that is very significant to him. And I don't think it's very easy for modern commentators, many of whom lack an understanding or empathy with religion, whether they are personally devout or not, they lack any empathy with it as a political principle. I think it's often very difficult for people to understand that. And I also think that people are so much driven by their present notions. Now, the present notions is that empire is bad, democracy is good, monarchical power is an anachronism, imperial rule is an anachronism, slavery is an abomination. And all of those principles and views are entirely reasonable from the present perspective. But that does not mean that they are the appropriate way to understand the past, if that is what you're seeking to do. And what I've tried to do, both in my small George III book and in the big one, and I think they're both worth reading independently. I think they both are, they're differently organized, and they, you know, they draw on a lot of information. I would like to say, I mean, I think my George II is extremely good as well, but George II is far harder to write about because he didn't write himself very much, George I even less. But with George III, you feel almost that you can be sitting there and talking to him. And I think that that makes it really interesting to engage with a man who is a biographical figure, whereas so many of the people that one might write about are, in, to some extent or other, pre-biographical.
Well, we must leave it there. Jeremy Black, author of George III, Majesty and Madness, and also George III, The Last King of America. Thank you very much for talking to us about Farmer George.
A great pleasure, but could I also urge people who are interested to, you know, I'm not saying they should buy it, hopefully they should get it from the library, but to also read by George II, because one of the interesting things is, I think you can understand better George III if you've also worked on or read George II. And one of my bugbears against many of the people who have written on George III is they know nothing about his predecessor other than images that are flawed, and they haven't thought through the implications of what he faced, and therefore they don't understand really what was new and different about George III.
Well, grandfather and grandson, George II and George III, Jeremy Black, thank you very much.
Thank you.
If you've enjoyed listening to The Critic podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the offer of 3 issues for just £5 by heading to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk.